When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast. For more information on our debates, talks, and discussions, visit intelligencesquared.com and sign up to the newsletter.
I present Professor Joe Stiglitz.
Okay. Well, it's a real pleasure to be here and to see, as I say, so much interest in the issue of inequality. In a way, I can't help but say I wish that magnitude of interest had been shown last Thursday. The when you write something, you always hope that something will get a reaction. And when my book came out, I was actually a little bit pleased that the Wall Street Journal wrote an article, a review of the book, and they were complaining about inequality. I think they thought that there should be two more inequality, and I thought there was less, so we had a disagreement. Let me spend a minute talking about the origins of my own interest in the subject. I grew up in Gary, Indiana, which is a town on the southern shore of Lake Michigan, the history of which really reflects the history of industrialization and deindustrialization in the United States. It was founded in 1906 as the largest integrated steel mill in the world. It was a real company town. It was named after the chairman of the board of U.S. Steel. You can't be more of a company town than that. But it was in some ways, a very progressive town. The school system was led by somebody called Willard Wirt, who was a protege of John Dewey. So it introduced a lot of very progressive ideas. But even at the period when I was growing up, which was the late 50s, you couldn't but help notice the high level of inequality in this industrial America. You couldn't help but notice the high level of discrimination, economic segregation, the fact that episodically the parents of my classmates would be unemployed. There was a lot of labor strife. There would be strikes. What I didn't realize at the time was that was the golden age of capitalism. That was as good as it ever got. And if any of you were at Piketty's talk last week, one of the major contributions of Piketty's work is to point out that there has been a high level of inequality in not just the United States, but in most of the advanced countries, except in a short period from sometime around the 30s, particularly the end of World War II, and 1980. And I'll come back and talk about what it was that was characteristic of that and what has happened since. But that experience of growing up at this high level of inequality motivated me. I mean, it really engaged me as a young kid. I had intended to go on and to study physics. That's really what I wanted to do. But the inequality, the problems of inequality, kept gnawing at me, and so I switched at the end of my career at Amherst College to study economics, and I wrote my thesis. At the time, I wrote my thesis on the distribution of income and wealth. Now, you have to understand, at the time, And until actually very recently, the economics profession has been very hostile to any discussions of inequality. It's not just that they ignored it, and they did that systematically, but they were actually hostile. Bob Lucas, who was one of the, got a Nobel Prize, he's a professor at the University of Chicago, reflected an attitude that is very widespread. And he said, you know, one of the most poignant subjects that an economist can talk about is inequality. So it's not surprising with that kind of attitude that economists ignored it in the standard models that economists used before the crisis. There was no discussion of inequality. In fact, they assumed there would be no effect of the distribution of income was simply not important. Well, I published my thesis, the main chapter of my thesis, in a journal called Econometrica. And I still think, as I reread it recently, that it provided the definitive treatment of the subject. I still think people should read it. But the point I wanted to make about this is that just a few years ago, about 4 years ago, Vanity Fair asked me to write an article about inequality. And that got read by a lot more people than my Econometrica article. So the point I wanted to make about all this is that if you're a young scholar, if you want attention to your work, you ought to be publishing in Vanity Fair, not in Econometrica. But that Vanity Fair article really summarizes a central thesis of this book, The Great Divide. The title of that article was "Of the 1%, for the 1%, and by the 1%. And that short sentence, short title, really summarizes an important aspect of inequality. It's not about economic forces. I'll come back and talk about that more. It's not about economic forces. It's about politics. It's about how politics shapes our economy. And it's being shaped now by the 1%. For those of you who haven't spent a lot of time reading American history, the title was an echo of a speech that every young American has to learn. In the middle of the Civil War between the North and the South of the United States, President Lincoln gave this famous address called the Gettysburg Address, and we all have to study that. And the critical line there was he was trying to justify why we had gone to war against each other, why we were fighting that war. And his basic line was whether government of the people, for the people, and by the people will perish from this earth. That was a little bit American-centric to think we were the only place where this was going on, where democracy. But the point I was trying to make for the American audience was that, in fact, it had perished in some sense, but not through a war, but through a failure to have a real democracy working, that it was no longer a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, but a government of the 1%, for the 1%, and by the 1%. Well, that article itself led the New York Times to ask me to curate a series of articles which we called The Great Divide. And the point of these articles was to bring to the American people the nature of the great divide that was dividing our society and many countries around the world. That there were these huge divisions between the rich and the poor. And the division, as you say, you know, the 1% became the slogan of the Occupy Wall Street. It was a division not between the middle class and the upper class. It was a division between the 1%, or as the data actually shows, the 0.1%, and the rest, the 99%. And this was a fundamental shift in our thinking about what the nature of American society was, because we had all thought of ourselves as the middle-class society. We had created a middle-class society. In fact, many of us prided ourselves being the first middle-class society. But that was in the 50s, in this golden age of capitalism. And by now, by, you know, the beginning of the 21st century, it was clear that that wasn't the defining characteristic, that we had not grown together, we had actually grown apart. So this book is began as that sort of series of articles I wrote in the New York Times, which I think did succeed in awakening an awareness of this great divide in the United States. And there are many discussions of how American leadership has spread this to other countries all over the world. And one of the other themes is that while America has excelled, it has the highest level of inequality of any of the countries in the world, the countries that have followed the American model are not falling far behind. And of course, the UK is among the countries that have been following the American model. In fact, in the rest of the world, it's referred to as the Anglo-American model. Not Angela Merkel, but Anglo-American. And that is something that should be very troubling here in the UK, because things have gotten much worse. So what I try to do in the book is talk about the dimensions of inequality, the causes, the consequences, and the policies that might enable us to do something about it. So in these few minutes, what I want to do is very, very quickly go through each of these topics and just touch on a few of them. As I said, there's been this enormous increase in inequality, and it has multiple dimensions. There is more money at the top. At the beginning, in Reagan, when Reagan in 1980 started pushing for the kinds of changes in economic policy, there was an awareness that those policies would lead to more inequality. The idea was that you lower tax rates at the top and you free up the economy, you deregulate. And the hope was, the idea was that it would, yes, there would be more inequality, but the size of the pie would increase so much so that everybody, even those in the middle and the bottom, would be better off. They would get a bigger piece, even if they got a smaller share. Well, we've had a third of a century now of this experiment, and we can see the outcome. They were right that it would increase inequality, and the share going to the top 1% has gone to numbers between 20 and 25%. That's a twofold increase. And the share going to the top 0.1% has increased 3 to 4-fold. But unfortunately, this idea of trickle-down economics, that everybody would benefit, is absolutely wrong. And what has actually happened is median income in the middle, has stagnated. Income at the bottom is even worse. So in the middle, income today, the median income of in the United States, adjusted for inflation, is lower than it was a quarter of a century ago. And at the bottom, the minimum wage has not increased for 45 years. So I think that an economic system that doesn't increase standards of living for a majority of its citizens over a period of a quarter century, and at the bottom has people worse off than they were almost 50 years ago, is a failed economic system. I said to put it slightly differently. Assume in 1980, people had come to American people and said, I have a deal for you. I'm going to make some reforms, and the consequences of these, quote, reforms, everybody uses the word reforms, the consequences of these reforms are going to be that the bottom 90% of the population will see no increase in income over the next third of a century. But the economy will grow and the top 10% will see some increase in income. How many Americans would vote for that deal? But it wasn't sold that way. It was sold quite differently, that it was actually everybody was going to be better off. And then it's been an incremental system of building a system of inequality, and that's going to be that's one of the major themes. We built a system of inequality over a long period of time without ever thinking about it. But now, as we look back on what's happened over a third of a century, we ought to be able to reflect on what's going on and say, we have created, in a sense, a failed economic system. It's not the market economy that's at fault. It's the way we shaped the market economy, and we shaped it in ways that have worked poorly for a very large fraction. So just a few charts which illustrate this. And this shows the U-shaped curve, the kind of data that Piketty talked about last week, where the top 1% reached a very high peak right before the Great Depression. Not an accident. And then came down. And then, as you see, right before the 2009 crisis, went up again to a very high level. But actually, unlike other crises, this has been actually another one where, in the United States, we again tried trickle-down economics, and again it didn't work. Just to show you how bad things were, in the 3 years after Obama and the Federal Reserve declared the end of our recession in 2009, 91% of all the gains went to the top 1%. So if you want to understand why most Americans are not very, don't think that there was a swindle, that, you know, the president said, oh, you know, the economy is growing again, wasn't true for 99% of Americans. And this is another graph showing the fact that in the middle, median half above, half below, the income in 2013 was actually lower than it was a quarter century ago. You know, when you talk about median income, it's obviously an average of different groups in our society, different demographic, social demographic groups. One particular demographic group that I feel a lot of empathy for are males. And if you look at the median income of male workers in the United States, they're lower than they are 40 years ago. So if you want to understand why there is a certain amount of anger you sometimes see in American politics among males, particularly white males, you get a part of that shows you part of the reasons. Well, income is only one aspect of inequality. There inequalities in wealth are even greater. Eight Americans who've inherited their money from two families, neither of which engaged in good practices. I mean, actually really bad. I won't describe how bad they are. But those eight people have more wealth than the bottom 44% of America, which is testimony, of course, to how little wealth there is at the bottom, as well as how much wealth there is at the top. In the United States, we have high levels of inequality of health because we don't have a public health service, a national health service. And that means if you're poor, if you're a poor kid, you don't get access to health care. Obama tried to rectify that, but there's been enormous opposition, and it's still in many parts of the country, particularly in the South, if you are poor, you do not have access to public health. And it shows up in the statistics in a very dramatic way. Among poor American, say, women, there's been a decline. Those who don't graduate from high school, for instance, there's been a decline in life expectancy of 3-4 years. As bad as what's been happening in Russia, it is really amazing what is going on. And there are also inequalities in access to justice. One of the essays in the book talks about these inequalities in access to justice. So I jokingly say, you know, every morning Americans, young kids have to, we have these rituals where you pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And one of the lines is with justice for all. And we've now amending that to say with justice for all who can afford it. So our view even of a justice is changing. Now, of all the aspects of inequality, I think the most invidious and most inconsistent with our self-image is inequalities of opportunity. That, you know, Americans like to think, and others look at America and say, it's a country of equal opportunity. And yes, there are some people who do make it from the bottom to the top or middle to the top. And there are some very talented immigrants who are able to make it from the bottom to the top. But when a social scientist and economist talks about equality of opportunity, they're not talking about these exceptions. What they're talking about is what happens on average. And you ask that question, it turns out that America has less equality of opportunity than even old Europe. And in old Europe, I put England. We have much less equality of opportunity than say the Scandinavian countries. What that means, in effect, in statistical sense, is that the life prospects of young American are more dependent on the income and education of his parents than in other advanced countries. So I tell my students, there's only one important decision you can make in your life, and that's choosing the right parent. And if you flub up on that, the game is over. The fact that there is this relationship, that the U.S. Has such a low level of inequality, is not a surprise at all, because there's a systematic relationship between inequalities of income, outcomes, and inequality of opportunity. Those countries that have a high level of inequality of incomes also have a low level of equality of opportunity. So what you see in that little graph with little flags to sort of illustrate this is the Scandinavian countries have low levels of inequality, high levels of equality of opportunity. And down at the bottom, up at the top, are the United States, and UK is up there too, with very low levels of equality of opportunity or measures of mobility. There are other metrics, all of which give basically the same picture. The channels through which this occur are complicated, and I don't have time to talk about them tonight. Maybe in the question period we'll be able to get to it. Let me spend just a few minutes now talking about some of the major ways in which our understandings of inequality have changed in the last 10 years or so. One of them has to do with the observation I made earlier that inequality fell from the peak in the periods of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and that was what most economists had thought was going to happen. Kuznets, who was a great, great economist in the middle of the 20th century and got a Nobel Prize, enunciated a notion, an empirical regularity that has since been called Kuznets' law. He was too modest to call it a law, but his paper raised the idea, showed the empirical evidence, that as countries in the early stages of development, some parts of the country pull out from others, and there's a growth in inequality. We see that in China. But then as they get more advanced, inequality comes down as those that are parts of the country, those individuals that are further behind, catch up, and so the inequality gets reduced. So that's what most people thought was going to happen. And it was happening in the 50s, 60s. But then, as those diagram showed earlier, around 1980, things started turning the other way. So there's been this repeal of the Kuznets' law. And there's a big debate going on. What is the reason for it? Now, one aspect of that was that the period after World War II was an unusual period. There had been a high degree of social cohesion. The countries could pull together. It was a period in which, both in Europe and the United States, was the fastest period of economic growth. But it was a period of shared prosperity where, while all segments of the economy grew, those at the bottom grew faster than those at the top. So that was, and it's interesting when you reflect back on that and some of the economic policies in that era. The top tax rates in the United States was 91%. If you listen to some of the debate today, you would say 91%, why didn't anybody even show up to work? But in fact, as I say, not only did they show up to work, it was the fastest period of economic growth. By 1980, that period of social solidarity that had brought people together started to wane, had waned. The 70s was a difficult period. And so that's when the ideas of Reagan and Thatcher came up of an alternative course. But this is where there are actually, you might say, two different theories, two different interpretations of what happened. The facts are clear. Beginning in 1980, we started to pull apart. We started to have this great divide. Piketty says, in effect, that what we are doing now is a restoration towards the normal laws of capitalism. Capitalism is naturally marked by high levels of inequality. And what I argue in the book, that's not true. That it's not an inevitable characteristic of capitalism, of a market economy. It's the consequences of the policies. That beginning around 1980, the set of policies that we pursued changed, and we created a peculiar kind of capitalism. It's not even, the 2008 crisis brought home the peculiar nature of our capitalism, where we socialized losses and we privatized gains. That's not capitalism, the ordinary kind. The system of corporate governance is not ordinary capitalism, where the management serves their own interest and not the interest of the corporation, not the interest of the workers, not the interest even of the shareholders. It's a kind of short-sighted capitalism that is really not functioning very well. So the basic argument that I try to put forward in this book is that it's, as I say, it's not about the inherent characteristics of capitalism. It's about the way we structure it. One of the reasons why I feel very confident about that is as we look around the world, what we see is very different levels of inequality and inequalities of income, inequalities of opportunity. The economic forces are roughly similar in all the advanced countries. You know, the forces of technology, forces of globalization, these are global forces. And if it were just the laws of nature that were driving what's going on, then the outcomes would be similar in all the countries. But there are very large differences. In fact, in some countries, in recent years, there's been a significant decline in inequality, even though the changes in technology are the same as, and the nature of globalization is the same as what's happening us in the United States and in leading to the high level of inequality. So the implication of this is it's our policies, not the inexorable economic forces that are at play. Inequality is a choice. It is a result of how we structure the economy through our tax and expenditure policies, through our legal frameworks, our institutions, even the conduct of our monetary policy. So I mean, just dwell on that for just a minute, because most people don't think, well, what does monetary policy have to do with inequality? Well, the fact is that if you run a monetary policy that focuses on inflation and not unemployment growth in jobs, you're going to wind up with a monetary policy where you tighten too soon and you wind up with wages over time going down, unemployment being higher, bargaining power of workers being weaker, and inequality increasing. And the interesting thing is that finally, central banks are beginning to realize this. Janet Yellen, who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the United States, gave a speech where she talked about inequality. Very criticized by those who said she should focus on monetary policy. But the point is that inequality is very much related to monetary policy. And more recently, what I found quite striking was that Draghi recently gave a speech where he pointed out that QE leads to more inequality. It's one of the factors that you have to take into account in monetary. It may not stop you from engaging in QE, but if you look in the United States, how did QE work? It was another attempt at trickle-down economics, that you lower interest rates, get stock market prices up. You hope that the people whose wealth is going up will spend a little bit more money, and everybody will as a result, benefit. But what had happened is unambiguously the case, wealth inequality increased as a result of QE. So the thrust of all this is that if you want to understand inequality and how we created it, you might say, brick by brick, step by step, over a third of a century by the amalgam of lots of different policies in all the areas that have created systems of corporate governance that have a short-termism, systems of monetary policy that focus more on inflation in the financial market than on employment and jobs. As you go down the list of every aspect of our economic structure, you can see how they contributed to the growth of inequality. A second major change has been it used to be that we thought that if we want more equality, we'd have to give up on economic performance growth. And now we realize that these are complementary. And this is not just a radical view or a left-wing view. The IMF, which is not exactly a radical institution, has been highlighting all over the world, emphasizing that countries need to worry about inequality because high levels of inequality are associated with poorer economic growth and more instability. There are many reasons for this, but I can see my time is running up, so let me just go on and just try to emphasize two more points. One is, because inequality is the result of policies, it is shaped by our politics. And this is the critical vicious circle, stronger in the United States than in other countries, but other countries are following our lead, that when you have the level of economic inequality that you have in the United States and in some other countries, it's going to get translated into political inequality. And that political inequality is then going to get translated into policies that lead to even higher levels of economic inequality. The last election in the United States, 2012 presidential election, each candidate spent over $1 billion. And the next presidential election is expected to cost a multiple of that. We have a euphemism. We talk about campaign contributions as if they were like charitable contributions. But the real answer is when the banks make a campaign contribution, they're making an investment. And they get higher returns from those political investments than they do from their financial investments, which we know before the crisis were a disaster. So that's part of the process of how inequality shapes the politics, which then reinforces the economic inequality. It was really the refrain that was at the title of my original article. There are broad consequences for this inequality. It's not just a moral issue. It does hurt our economy. It undermines our democracy. It divides our society. Today, increasingly in the United States, there's a perception that the basic necessities of a middle-class society are increasingly out of reach of large portions of the population. Things like the ability to send your children to college, retirement security, even the ability to own a home. So finally, let me just say that I want to convey a certain kind of urgency to these issues, that incremental changes won't solve the problem. They're important, but one needs a comprehensive agenda to address them. So yes, it's important to improve equality of opportunity through education. It's important to raise the minimum wage from the level that it's been, you know, that hasn't, people at the bottom haven't gotten a pay raise for almost a half century. Those are important steps. But unless we see what has happened as the result of the way we've structured our whole economy, unless we go about rewriting the rules of our market economy in a much more comprehensive, systematic way, we won't really solve the problem. And finally, a certain note of urgency. I wish there was that note of urgency last week. But the note of urgency, because if the wrong decisions are made, the consequences are going to be felt for a long time. The path where we are today is the result of a path that we began a third of a century ago. The decisions that we're going to be making now are going to bake in the nature of inequality for the next quarter of a century. So that's particularly why, while you know, it's absolutely necessary to begin step by step, the fact is unless we have the vision of the alternative towards which we want to go, we won't make the kind of aggressive kinds of actions that are going to be necessary to turn us away from the kind of path that we've been on now, both in the United States and the UK, unfortunately, for a third of a century. A path which I think is leading to a weaker economy, undermining our democracy, and in the end, dividing our society. Thank you.
Which I'm glad you ended on a light, bright note. Isn't the problem with inequality the criticism that was levelled at me when I tried to kind of hawk stories to my news editors at previous newspapers and things? I gave them a story about inequality and they were like, well, inequality is just boring. No one really cares about inequality. It's too dreary to get in the newspaper. And don't we see a reflection of that in what happened a week and a half ago, whereby people, when given the choice in the ballot box on a kind of, you know, what was pretty close, the closest thing we'll have for some time as being a referendum on do you want a party which is going to hit back against inequality or a party who is not ostensibly going to do that, they didn't vote for the fight against inequality. Why is that? Is it because people just are inclined not, you know, to choose hope over that kind of, you know, the inequality?
I mean, there is an element of that economics is the dismal science, and selling dismality is never easy. So I think there is, you know, the kind of message of audacity, of hope. You know, Reagan ran on Good Morning America, and it was actually the beginning of the decline, but it was a good morning. And that it was obviously a positive message. But I think you shouldn't over-interpret an election, because there's always personalities. There's always...
Oh, it was Zeb Miliband's fault.
Well, I should say, there are many elements that go into it. I think that almost surely was a factor. I think that its persuasiveness, and, you know, even though no serious economist takes austerity seriously, there are some people here that do. And, you know, what is quite remarkable to me, you know, I had a lot of fights about austerity back when I was chief economist of the World Bank about the austerity that the IMF was imposing in East Asia. But eventually the IMF saw the light, and they, you know, have been writing reports that actually when you have a significant decline, like after 2009, austerity lowers economic performance. Absolutely clear. The evidence is overwhelming on this. There are a few people who've written articles about this fictional thing called expansionary contraction, you know, sort of oxymorons. But we've even gone through all those cases of expansionary contractions. And guess what? Contractions are contractionary.
but hold on, the UK isn't doing that badly at the moment. The IMF has said, you know, and Barack Obama said recently, you know, you're clearly doing something right. So austerity isn't surely necessarily the wrong thing.
When you say, you know, in economics, the hardest thing is what we call counterfactual history. What would have happened? And you had a big advantage of the European Central Bank focused simply on inflation. So you had a better monetary policy. You know, you can't just count always on your neighbors having really bad policies. So they were focusing on inflation. You know, Trichet even raised the interest rates after the crisis. You know, and so why is that important? If they raise your interest rates, you're lowering your interest rate, your exchange rate becomes favorable. Those are circumstances in which, in spite of the cutback in domestic spending, exports can grow and fill some of the gap. But one of the great successes of Osborne and the Conservative government is they talked about austerity but didn't always preach it. So if you talk one way and then you cut back on your cutting back. Yeah. Then you can say I'm doing austerity. You're not really doing austerity. Meanwhile, taking advantage of the mistakes going on in Europe. And then you can look reasonably good. But when I look at the UK economy, I don't see the rosy picture because...
It's the dismal science again.
Well, yeah, dismal. What I see is GDP lower than it was in 2008, you know, a lost... more than half decade.
Well, GDP is lower, but GDP is high, but GDP per capita.
Per capita is lower than it was. That's not a great success. What I see is wages, median income stagnating, productivity not doing very well. All these things are not exactly metrics that would say, boy, was that a success.
So what's in store then? We have just elected a majority Conservative government. What does that mean for the next 5 years, whether it's inequality or whether it's our recovery here in the UK?
Well, I think first you need to pray a lot. that's where I would begin. I think that there is serious risk. If what one reads in the newspaper, that there's going to be another dose of austerity, you know, a real dose, not that they aren't constrained.
Yeah, the fake austerity.
You know, recognizing that the global economy is relatively weak right now, there's a slowdown in what has been the engine of global economic growth, which is China, the emerging markets, recognizing that the ECB now has finally come to very low interest rates. So you're not going to have that competitive advantage, and that means your exchange rate will be higher. And even the United States economy, you know, last quarter we probably had negative growth when the preliminary numbers had 0.2% growth. but the revised numbers will probably come in negative. People are expecting this quarter, to be also very weak. So as I look at the global economy, it's not very strong. And in that context, you're not going to be saved in the way that you were saved by the mistakes of other countries. You're embedded in a world environment that is not very hopeful.
God, well, we're definitely going to have to pray then. So the paradox, though, in what you were saying about the UK recovery the first time around, is that we had a Bank of England that acted pretty quickly. And what it acted with was quantitative easing, which, as you said in your speech, is something that exacerbates inequality. And that may well go down in history. You know, QE in the UK and indeed elsewhere may go down in history as one of the biggest single events in terms of distributing wealth to a particular part of the population, because it is those who held assets, it's those who had shares, who had houses, particularly in London, who have done very well out of quantitative easing, and everyone else hasn't necessarily.
So, and in fact, it's even worse for people who were prudent in their retirement and bought government bonds. They're being devastated in both the United States and in other countries where they're QE. So it's actually hurt them. I mean, the people who save prudently are in very difficult positions.
Is the point that they should have done it differently?
No, we want people to be prudent, but then you change the rules of the game.
The Bank of England, should the Bank of England have acted differently? You know, should it have bought up? Should it have done a kind of helicopter drop on the population? Should it have started going out and buying people's houses? In fact, I worked out, actually, that QE in the UK, the Bank of England, with the amount of money they spent, they could have bought every single house in Scotland and Northern Ireland if they wanted to. So should they have gone out and done that and just kind of given the money directly to people? I mean, you know,
I think they should have been more aware of the distributive consequences and had think about policies like that. I don't, you know, one of the reasons why QE did not have the kinds of positive effects, as big effects as one had hoped, you know, even though it was massive in the United States, the balance sheet increased four times. You know, we're talking about trillions of dollars, and it had a little effect, but very, very little from this trickle down. One of the reasons is the credit channel was broken, and they didn't do anything about that. In other words, SME lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, actually years after the crisis began, years after QE began, was still 20% below the pre-crisis level. So they didn't fix the system. And in fact, in some ways, they made it worse because they allowed the banks to merge together, and so competition in the financial sector in the United States was actually lower. So when it came to giving mortgages, at least in the United States where I do know the data, what happened is that lower interest rates didn't translate into lower mortgage. What it really did is translate into higher profits for the banks.
Okay. During your presentation, you had one of the Piketty charts, the one about income. I don't know, can we put it up,
sure.
Income inequality? Oh, there we are. As if by magic, I didn't even touch anything. I'm curious about whether you think what we're seeing here is a curve that's just going to carry on going up and down as people get frustrated by inequality when it goes up, they impose more. Because that in part is what happened presumably in the 1930s. People finally, you know, politicians finally imposed policies that were more redistributive. You had things like welfare states being imposed. Are we just going to have perpetual curves like this way into the future?
Well, first, let me try to emphasize, it's not just the redistributive policies. It was the way the whole economy worked. So one of the things what we did in the 30s is that we passed in the United States something called the Wagner Act, which gave more bargaining power to workers. So we encouraged more collective bargaining, and that had a big effect.
And Glass-Steagall.
And Glass-Steagall, well, which
was splitting up the banks.
That's right. So we did a lot of things to change our economic structure, and that's why, you know, the big agenda right now is this agenda that we came out with last Tuesday in Washington, called Rewriting the Rules. So it was an agenda for showing how you, by rewriting the rules, you can get more equality before tax and transfer. And it's not just education, that's important. It's not just the minimum wage, although that's important. It's the way our corporate governance, our financial system,
our legal system, labor
institutions, bankruptcy, all these work together. And it's gotten a lot of resonance in the United States. So, yeah, to go back to this wave thing, I think there is something about that. Albert Hirschman actually wrote something about the waves in the political economy and in a different area. And I think there is something about that. What worries me today and distinguishes today from, say, the Gilded Age, in the Gilded Age where inequality got very high, then we responded by passing all the antitrust laws in the progressive era. What's different today is the power of money in politics is greater than it ever been. And that worries me. Will we be able to bring that down?
Hi, I'm just a normal person and not a one percenter. What can I do?
Okay, good question. Okay, and the lady there.
Yes, I'd like to ask about the concerns about low productivity and wages staying quite low. One of the characteristics, particularly in this country, we've seen is that we've had a high level of immigration from Europe where there are not very many jobs, together with a lot of people coming off the unemployment registers here. We've seen unemployment drop very sharply and a starting of a change of feeling that levels of 5, 6% unemployment are perfectly normal and reasonable when 60s and 70s, you might have thought 3% was the sort of ideal rate of unemployment for turnover. To what extent is this actually quite a large driver of why wages have stayed, average wages have stayed, perhaps particularly for non-middle class jobs, relatively low, because you've got actually an enormous number of new people coming onto the job market,
so immigration.
Competition from China.
Okay.
What is that contributing?
Hi. Thanks very much, Professor. I have a couple of questions. First, I mean, I couldn't agree more on the inequality of opportunity. There should be equality of opportunity. But the question I have is, what about the free rider problem? So in the other types of inequality that you've outlined, so for example, in some of the European countries, you're having problems now because of the welfare state and there's a sense of entitlement. So that's having, that okay. I think is one of the arguments against having this active debate on inequality. And
the free rider problem.
Yeah.
Somebody who's not in the 1%, what can they do to influence the outcome? So I guess the best thing you could do is to become in the 1%. that's more likely to have any other impact than anything else. But
and have the right parents as well.
And have the right parents. I mean, that's easy. So, but if you can't do those two things, I think civil society action, political action, is the only way this is going to change. And I think what, in my own mind, and I don't want to comment on the British election, but...
feel free.
What one sees is that elections can be very close, and the outcomes can depend on voter turnout. And it could have been different if there had been different turnouts. Those votes.
So
at least in my mind, the kind of civic society actions that make governments more aware of the consequences of these rules and make it more difficult for them to accept. So let me give you one example. Right now, there's an attempt to rewrite the rules through TTIP. And that
this
will
is the trade deal.
The trade deal. It's really a fundamental change in the way the rules that govern how regulations that affect health, labor, almost anything are made. It's taking them away from democratically elected government and moving them up to a higher level and to trade negotiators, and then making it rigid, very difficult to change with a change in economic circumstances. So in my mind, it's really important for there to be a strong civil society reaction to say, you know, particularly the investment agreement, the intellectual property provisions of that.
So get out there and protest.
The United States set a good example in Seattle when we had a good protest against the WTO initiative back in 1999. I think that's a kind of example that others ought to...
Take to the streets.
Take to the streets. Maybe with not quite so much violence, but still.
And the second question was about the labor market and changes in the labor market and the way that's...
Yeah. Traditionally, this is actually where economists began the analysis. Economists began the analysis by focusing on demand and supply factors. And so they say, okay, there's an increase in the supply of labor, migration, trade, indirect competition from workers from other countries, other developing countries, through the globalization process. Those are important. I don't want to minimize the importance, and they do have effects on distribution of income. And that's related actually to the trade issue, those who are advocating these trade measures don't really reveal one of the strongest theorems in economics, which is if you had actually perfectly free trade in perfectly functioning markets, and we don't have perfectly functioning markets, so I'm going to make that clear. But if you had that, and the kind of models that the advocates of trade often argue for, the wages of unskilled workers in the UK would be the same as the wages of unskilled workers in China. And, you know, that's not a good selling point, obviously, for free trade. But I haven't heard Obama saying, you know, this is as one of the great achievements that he's going to get the wages of our unskilled workers down to those of China. He's not been actually selling that as part of his trade agreement, but there is a strong force in that direction, unless you take other measures to mitigate against that, and you can take certain actions, but that won't happen on their own. But the point I've been emphasizing is that it's really about the rules of the game, including these trade rules, the rules of corporate governance, competition policy, and a set of issues that we haven't talked enough about, education.
Okay.
And that makes people have skills that make them able to compete with others.
Just if have I, 1 minute. It's 1 minute for the final couple of questions.
Okay. On this question about whether the kind of agenda that I've talked about would weaken growth because it would destroy incentives. First, let me emphasize what I said before. The evidence is overwhelming that equality and growth are complements. And so if you look at the ways that inequality has grown in the United States and in other advanced countries, it's actually been destructive of economic growth and economic performance. If you had taxed the bankers at a higher rate, would it have meant that we would have had less banking? Maybe, but that would be good for the economy. if you look at what's happening to the financial sector, it went roughly, from 2.5-3% of GDP to 8%. It went from it went to the point before the crisis, it was getting about almost 40% of all corporate profits. There was no evidence that that kind of income led to any improvement in economic performance. The financial sector talks about all the innovations they had. And you might enjoy this particular repartee. Paul Volcker once said, there was not a single innovation in America's financial market that had led to improved economic performance, except the ATM machine. And then I always point out that the ATM machine was a British innovation, not American innovation.
There we
are. So that there was not a single innovation of America's financial market. And at least you have the ATM machine.
Well, that's a very positive note on which to end. Good old Britain. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Thank you for your questions. I'm so sorry we didn't get to take all of those questions, but they were absolutely brilliant, the ones we did have. Thank you for coming. Thank you so much to Professor Stiglitz. It's been a fascinating evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can download more Intelligent Squared podcasts free on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you'd like to find out more about our events, sign up to our newsletter at intelligentsquared.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.